copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
All right, let's continue on with this question of is there evidence that change is possible? Most of the rest of the world would obviously say no. And in the United States, and that's, as I said at the beginning, that's where I'm coming from, my perspective, but I have friends in England as well. But the American Psychological Association, the American Counseling Association, have moved to have what's called conversion therapy, not conversion to Christianity, but conversion from gay to straight, banned as unethical, unenlightened, ineffective, prejudiced, and homophobic. And the in England, the Counselors and Psychotherapists bill that is just before Parliament, I think very soon. Is anyone English here who knows about this? No? Threatens to remove from the register of professional psychotherapists and counselors anyone who is involved with gay to straight therapy. Okay? So now, of course, everyone affirms gay affirmative therapy. That's a good thing. You can affirm people in their gayness and with their identity. And they would say that there is evidence that harm is caused by trying to get people to change. You're actually moving against who they are as people, and you will do them harm. Now, if we look back, before homosexuality was taken off the list of disorders in America with the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is the sort of the psychologist's Bible, in 1973, homosexuality was removed. So before 1973, there was actually quite a lot of research done because people were trying to help folk to change. Psychoanalysts, behaviorists, cognitive therapists, group therapists were all trying all sorts of things. And there was in this research, which admittedly is not necessarily highly sophisticated research, an average significant positive outcome across these studies of about 33% of some change in the direction of heterosexuality from homosexuality. If you look at Kinsey's scale again, as we did earlier on, what we're saying when we talk about change, we're not necessarily talking about from 6 to 1 or 0, but probably it might be from 6 to 4 or 5 to 3 or 5 to 4, an incremental change. Now, a few people would claim to have changed a long way from, say, 5 to 1 or 2, and we'll come to that in a moment. But most of the research since 1973 has obviously been done by religious-oriented approaches. So where there are folk who believe they want to try to change, and they've gone into some sort of counseling, some sort of pastoral care, some sort of professional therapy. Many of them have been with pastoral counselors and support groups like Exodus International. This was run recently by a man called Alan Chambers, and I'll say a little more about him in a moment. These perhaps are the three main approaches to helping people that are current. The pastoral counselor support groups, Exodus International is a sort of umbrella organization of many other support groups that do that, that work with folk to try and help them to change. Now, in the last year or two, Alan Chambers he is married, but he is same-sex attracted to some degree, and he has shut down the organization Exodus International, saying we were too optimistic about change. We thought we could help everyone to change, but we've realized it doesn't happen as easily as that. So we're not offering people a cure now. And this hit the headlines in the United States as a sort of recantation from someone who'd been doing it a long time. The sexual identity therapy, this is with Mark Yarhouse and Warren Throckmorton, Yarhouse's book I mentioned earlier. And you can look that up on the sexualinstitute.org. It's a more sophisticated form of helping people to come to terms with their sexual orientation and to conform what they experience within themselves with their values, with their Christian belief, not necessarily with huge expectation of change, although there may be some along the way. And I'll give you more of Mark Yarhouse's research in a moment. And then reparative therapy is what typically is sort of seen as conversion therapy. This comes from a more psychodynamic, psychoanalytically oriented group in California called NAATH with Joseph Nicolosi. And he focuses, especially in men, on the deficit in the relationship with the same-sex parent. He works very intensively over a period of months and years and claims that people can change to some degree. I haven't seen good research from his organization recently, but I do have a study that was done in 98 that he did. And he claims out of 882 religious people who were seeking change, who had experienced change, there were 78% of them were men, 22% of them were women. The average age of their awareness of their homosexual tendencies was about 12 and a half. And 726 of them, 82%, had therapy from a professional therapist or a pastoral counselor in something like working under the auspices of something like Exodus International. And 18% of them had support from friends, family, or an ex-gay ministry. That was their main form of help. And he claims that 68% of them were exclusively or almost exclusively homosexual. In other words, on the Kinsey scale, they were up at 4, 5, 6 at one time in their lives. And after this therapy, only 13% perceived themselves in this manner. So a suggestion that 55% of them had had some significant change. 35% were unsuccessful in making any changes, and the average age of entering therapy was around 30. So many of these men had been in the gay lifestyle or struggling with same-sex attraction for quite a while. And the average length of therapy was 3.5 years. So now you notice here, this is an important factor. This is not just something over a few weeks of counseling. This is going to be something that is over a very significant period of time. Like any struggle that we have, whether it's with anger or alcoholism or with depression, these deep-seated parts of our struggle with our fallen nature take a lot of work, a lot of time in the context of a healing relationship. Now, that study has been critiqued for its methodology, but it does seem to suggest that there is some change that happens. How long it lasts, I mean, these people weren't followed up, as far as I know, in any scientific way, 5 years later, 10 years later. I'm sure a number of them did relapse. And that would be true in any disorder that you find that maybe a third of people have significant change, a third have medium change, and a third have no change at all. Yeah?
Do you recall whether these therapies were done at the request of the individual or whether they were prescribed by the doctor?
No, I think these were all voluntary. These were people who were going
people
to it.
Wanted to.
Wanted, yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, a lot of the folk who criticize conversion therapy often quote examples of people who were given electric shock treatment, you know, shown pictures of women, men who were shown pictures of women and men who were shown slides of naked men, and if they got aroused, then they were given an electric shock, you know, to try and decondition them. That's old behaviorist stuff that nobody uses anymore, as far as I know. But sometimes that's the image people have of those sorts of treatments. So the question is, how has this undergoing this therapy influenced their wholeness, just who they are? Yeah, I mean, in one study that was done with a psychiatrist, a couple actually, who were both psychiatrists, the Pattersons, back in the 80s, I think it was, they found, they had a group of men from a Pentecostal church, in the context of a Pentecostal church, that had a ministry to gay people. And these, out of these, I think 11 men were sort of chosen for the study out of a larger group. And all of them had some significant change. And what they noticed was all of them felt that they had deficits in their ability to relate to other people well. So they grew in their ability to relate both to men and women, in their confidence, and just generally became more mature as people through the process. And that wasn't even in professional therapy. That was in just a good, caring church environment. So there's a sort of, I think there is a growing of maturity in relationships. We'll come back to that too. What these people talked about in, as a result of this, was a decrease in their homosexual thoughts, their fantasies, their masturbation, their overt homosexual behavior. And as we've said here, an improvement in their overall psychological health. And that 99% of them believed that some change is possible after they went through this. Now, I would love to see a long-term follow-up of this group. Another interesting person that came on the scene some years ago was Robert Spitzer. He's not a Christian. He's a research a psychiatrist. And in 1973, he was one of the architects of the American Psychological Association voting to remove homosexuality from the list of disorders in the DSM. But he was intrigued because when he was there, there were a lot of protesters outside in more recent meetings of the APA who were saying gays and lesbians can change. So here he is speaking on the right there, and all these people protesting the APA meeting. So he decided to do research on these people. He was intrigued by them, and so he did a telephone survey in 2001 of 143 men and 57 women who in 5 years previously had made some sort of sustained effort to change. And he had a structured 45-minute interview with these people. He said 66% of the men and 44% of the women who had rarely or never felt any opposite sex attraction now had good heterosexual function. And there was a spectrum of how much they had changed. And he ended up he had great difficulty publishing this data in a professional journal. It was strongly resisted. Eventually did get it published in 2003, and he said, contrary to conventional wisdom, some highly motivated individuals using a variety of change efforts can make substantial change in multiple indicators of sexual orientation and achieve good heterosexual functioning. And then he went on to say, the mental health professionals should stop moving in the direction of banning therapy that has as a goal a change in sexual orientation. So this was a really surprising thing, and we as Christians were very glad there was some secular expert who was researching this and saying that change was possible. Well, the sad thing is he got a lot of criticism, a lot of heat on his methodology, and sure enough, there are some flaws in it, but I don't think it was all completely bad. But in 2011, he made a public retraction. How much was that public pressure? He's now in his 80s. I'm not sure that he wanted to go out from the APA scene as being rejected by his colleagues, and presumably got back into their good graces by his retraction. Now, the most, I think, probably the best done study in this area by Christians again, by Jones and Yarhouse, and they've published it in a book called Ex Gaze, A Longitudinal Study of Religious Mediated Change in Sexual Orientation. They had 98 subjects in a prospective study and followed them up 7 years later. And 23% of these reported conversion, in quotes, from homosexuality to predominant heterosexuality. 30% reported chastity. In other words, they were able to live celibate lives, and a reduction in same-sex attraction, but not, it wasn't gone. And then 29% were in the process of change, but were with uncertain success. And 15%+ had no change at all. So the change, again, was on this continuum. It might have just been from 4 to 3 on the Kinsey scale. So the conclusion of their study was that changes away from same-sex attraction and towards heterosexual functioning in some dimensions occur in 45 to 65% of these people. The majority do not experience complete change of orientation. So changes on all dimensions, just 10 to 15% of males and 30% of females. And change is slow and difficult and takes a lot of courage and persistence and sticking with it. These are all people who were in professional counseling or psychotherapy of some form or another, I believe. So from these studies, there is a body of evidence that points to change being possible, but difficult, and you never know quite how much change there is going to be, if there is going to be any. The American Psychological Association report in 2009, this is sort of an abstract and a summary of it, they conducted a systematic review and concluded that efforts to change sexual orientation are unlikely to be successful. Thus, the results of scientifically valid research indicate that it is unlikely that individuals will be able to reduce same-sex attractions or increase other sex attractions through sexual orientation change effort. And essentially, in that report, I think that they ignored some positive evidence. But you know, this is where I said earlier on that all of us Christians are affected by their assumptions and non-Christians are affected, and you can easily interpret your results from your own particular philosophical assumptions. But I am persuaded that some change is possible, and there's lots of anecdotal evidence of some degree of change, as well as a lot of friends that I have who have experienced no change. And that's what we have to come to in a few minutes of how do we help? What's our responsibility? How can we be agents of redemption and reconciliation in this whole area? We've laid out the scene. What do we do? What does it mean to love? And I think the first thing that, as I've hinted at already, is to build friendships. Actually, let me pause a moment here. Are there any questions about the area of research? Comments, thoughts? As you work around and with people, have you experience of talking with people who have changed, or most of the people that you meet don't experience much change?
See it like that.
No.
They don't see it at all like that. So
I mean, they feel it's derogatory if we speak of it as a disease.
Yes, exactly. And then even suggest or imply that a cure may be available or necessary or something like that.
Yeah. That's like saying racial, you know, you should change your race because there's something wrong with you because you're black rather than white. So you're right. Right.
These people are on a parallel universe that is not at all the way I would approach it medically.
You've highlighted a very important place that I feel that tension too, as we're talking with people. To believe it is something that is an abnormality or fallen, it's sort of, I sometimes use the analogy because I've done quite a lot of work on depression. You know, we see a proneness, a vulnerability to depression as something that is a combination of genetic and family influences and biology. We see it as an abnormality, and we accept that. And most people would accept that. And we are saying it's a parallel to that. Here is something that's part of the fallen world that we live in that God didn't intend. And ideally, we'd like to be able to fix it. But maybe this side of heaven and glory, it can't be fixed. Or maybe there is some change in some people that make them less vulnerable. But it is a real point of tension for us in communicating because most people don't have any concept of a fall or this is abnormal. Yeah.
I assume we teach a biblical view of marriage and sexual identity and so on. And a couple of years later, one of them got actual conviction of sin and broke up the relationship. And during a church service, it was her baptism, and she testified in front of the entire church. That still loved this woman. She was sitting in one of the pews. Didn't want to join her in making that decision, of course. But she said, I love her, but I love Jesus even more. The entire church was completely silent, and she made her break with her whole life and was baptized. Just what I want to say with this, it is possible to be agents of redemption and reconciliation.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you. I'm not going to try and retell your story. I hope the microphone maybe picked it up since I was close to you. But go ahead.
Does research say anything about the age at which people first seek treatment? Because anecdotally, that would seem to be the younger and more less experienced and more valuable someone is in a particular form of sexuality, the more likely they may be.
Yeah. As I said there, you know, the age was around 30 when they sought treatment. I think nowadays, with more help and it being more open and people willing to come for help more easily, if they do, they're more willing to talk about it younger. And if a young man or woman is confused about their sexual identity, I think we can do a lot to help them at an early age before they get fixed into a particular lifestyle pattern where they've had a number of same-sex relationships. But I saw a young man whose father was a pastor and asked me to see him. He was probably about 13 when I first saw him, same-sex attracted. And I saw him for about two and a half years. We established a really good relationship. He seemed to respect me, and I became a sort of another, I think, you know, having someone who wasn't his father. And he did have a little bit of a tense struggle with his father in his relationship. But he didn't really change much at all. He's gone off to college. I must be in touch with him again to find out how he's doing. But he did come to a place of increasing recognition that as a Christian, he was still same-sex attracted, but that he wanted to remain celibate. And that's where we're going to move in pursuing this further. Yeah.
Because he said the Christian view is that either there's a cure, so I have to be healed, or no sex. And there is no acceptance that this is my condition. So what is the short answer? So how shall we see them? We shall see them that I love you, but you are broken? Or what is the view? Because this is what I felt, that I love you, my brother, but you are broken. Jesus, he looked at me and said, do you know, it's really hurting that I have to face again that I'm broken. I said that I accepted that I'm not. So what would be a Christian response in this situation?
Well, you've set up the scene very nicely for what I'm going to say. You've given a good example of a man who's been in it for 15 years, feeling the struggle, is a Christian, feeling that he can't believe that he's condemned to a life without sex. Is that right? So what are his options? How can he, and can he be cured? I mean, these are all really important questions, and I'm going to talk a bit more about that.
But has there been research done on...
Well, you have the extremes of sort of the old behaviorist methodology in relation to change and the psychoanalytical. Then within the Christian world, you have the more charismatic Pentecostal prayer therapy, wanting instant healing. And then the more customary methodology is long-term relationship and the importance of developing non-sexual relationships with other people of the same sex and more maturity in relationships in general. That's the one, and helping you to have your identity in Christ rather than in your homosexuality. And that may involve counseling, which involves, you know, facing disappointments and hurts and anger from the past and forgiveness and coming to terms with what God is the way he's calling you to live. But nobody has compared, what you're asking is, nobody has compared those different methodologies in any sort of scientific way. Right, right.
So what do you think about that?
Well, the research that I quoted, I think, was doing research on people who had already been through some form of change therapy. And they were just telling the researcher, I first became aware at this age. So some would be 10, some 11, some 12, some 13. The average was 12 something. So they weren't dealing with people at that age. They were older. The question about does education affect? I think education affects our understanding of what we experience, doesn't it? What framework we put our feelings about our identity and our gender in depends on the story that we're living out. Is it the cultural story or is it a biblical story? And so what you are taught will affect you, but it doesn't, it's sort of how you live with what is there within you. So a young man at the age of 13 who's experiencing same-sex attraction, how does he interpret that? Is this something that's good or something that wasn't intended to be? What do I do with it? The question is about political action and how much we should resist people teaching the normality of homosexuality in schools and of gay marriage and so on. And that is a huge issue, because as we do that, we are going to bring persecution on ourselves. So it depends how courageous you are and in what circumstances and what the consequences will be. But personally, I think that we should speak up for what we believe marriage is and what we believe God... The way you do it, the strategy by which you do it, is really important, of course. Because you can do it in a very strident, negative way. Because you're going to be interpreted negatively however you do it, but some ways are better than others. Yeah, so I think building friendships, championing respect, dignity, and love of our neighbor for people of any sexual orientation. There's a case on the internet that you can look up in America of a guy called Shane Wendemeyer, who was the executive director, this is the guy on the left here, of an LGBT group, Campus Pride, and he was protesting outside the stadium where... this guy, Dan Cathy of Chick-fil-A. Do you have Chick-fil-A here in Europe? It's a sort of chain store of... You've heard of it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But he's the executive director of this, and he had a big football game organized by his organization. And there was big protest outside this and also outside the stores. because he speaks against homosexuality. And what happened was these two guys actually had a telephone conversation, and then they struck up a friendship, and they got into dialogue, and each trying to understand each other's perspective. And then they became much more respectful to each other publicly. They didn't give up what they were doing and believing, but at least they were able to dialogue in some respectful way. Another example that's been on the internet a lot too is this woman, Rosaria Butterfield, who's written the book The Secret Thoughts of an Unlikely Convert. And she is a leftist lesbian professor of English at a prestigious American university. And she started to, she did in her research, she was working on something to do with the Bible as literature or something. I can't remember exactly what her research was. But anyway, she had to read the Bible and she had to talk about it. She got into talking about it with a pastor, and the pastor befriended her and invited her to his home and had invited her for meals and get to know her, his family. And eventually she became a Christian. So they weren't actually talking much about homosexuality, and he wasn't addressing that. But she became a Christian and eventually got married and adopted children, has written this book about the change. She actually became a pretty extremist homeschooler and somewhat anti-culture person. But the example of being befriended by this pastor was a wonderful example of apologetics, of evangelism by friendship. And then, now how, in the book you don't get a sense of how strong her same-sex attraction was, but as we've seen in women, there seems to be more gender fluidity. And you spoke about a woman friend of yours who changed pretty dramatically after being married. That happens more with women than men, that this change. So the question of back to how do we love, it's building the friendships, I think welcoming into our homes and churches as fellow image bearers and sinners like us, sharing the gospel of God's love and grace and forgiveness that we all need when the time is right. And then when someone becomes a believer, you don't expect them to change dramatically immediately. It may be over time if they change at all. We don't expect huge changes in our struggles with anger or our proneness to depression or even our addiction to materialism. You know, a lot of us still covet a lot 10 years into being good Christians after your conversion. I certainly do after many years. So I think the important thing is the friendships, the family, the community, the teaching, the prayer, the counseling. And if the church is a hospital, as it is partly, for broken people, it's also an army and a family and all sorts of other things. But some intensive care counseling may be needed, as we talked about earlier on. And I think the most significant thing, and this is what we have found in St. Louis, we have an organization that's been going now for a number of years called First Light, which is an organization basically trying to help people who are struggling with their sexual brokenness. It's a para-church organization, we have a couple of full-time people working, a man and a woman. The woman is part-time, man is full-time director, a number of us on the board. And we have groups for men who are struggling with same-sex attraction. We have, at the moment, one group of men, one group of women, for women. We have a lot of groups, I think 7 or 8 groups now for men struggling with pornography and sexual addiction. And actually the struggles of the guys struggling with sexual addiction and those struggling with same-sex attraction are often very similar. They're just going in slightly different directions, but the actual heart struggles are similar. And then we have a group for the parents or the relatives of gay people. So there are a number of pastors in that group who have sons or daughters who are gay. And then we have two groups for the spouses of men struggling with sexual addiction. So, but what we have found is that these groups are just expanding, exploding. The need is so huge, especially in the area of sexual addiction, pornography, that I'll be talking about in another focal talk over this week. But the essence of these groups is that men come and find a place, men and women, come find a place where other people share their struggles. They find they're accepted just as they are with all the messiness of their lives. And they don't feel such an intense shame as they would going into the church in general. And they begin to talk about what they've struggled with, why they may struggle with it. They get into some sort of accountability group where they study maybe a book together and understand more of where their struggles come from. They struggle to study the Bible together. They pray together. And a lot of them, we recommend that as many as possible, if they can afford it, go for individual counseling as well. Now, a number of these people are married in the same-sex group. About probably 50% of the people in the group are married. But they have thought, maybe some of them thought that marriage would solve their problem. But of course it didn't, and it's re-emerged again in their marriage. So they have what we call a mixed orientation marriage, where they have a heterosexual spouse and predominantly homosexual. And for some of them, they have really adapted to that and learned to live with it and to be faithful within it and to work on their expectations of each other. So a mixed orientation marriage is possible. A struggle. But all marriage is a struggle, isn't it? For all of us who are married, we know that. but the group, the group thing, I think, is an incredible... We need to multiply these sorts of groups. Harvest in Philadelphia has done the same thing. We need to be educating the church and educating the folk who come to us and ourselves in this to provide a place where it's safe for people to share their struggles. Any area of addiction in our lives, whether it's sex, food, alcohol, drugs, internet, pornography, the main form is a sort of 12-step type group that provides a structure and a place where you can go and feel safe to work through your struggles. So that's a very important part of this. And what we have found is that within the Christian world now, what has happened in the evangelical world is there is this, what is called in the United States, side A and side B. The side A view would be God blesses same-sex marriages and you can be faithfully monogamous. And these folk, many of them have sort of reinterpreted scripture to fit what they believe they need to do. Side B is that God calls us to lifelong celibacy, or perhaps to a mixed orientation marriage if you are same-sex attracted. and you can see some of the debate about this at this website, gaychristian.net, the great debate between Justin Lee, who has written a book called Torn, who would be on the side A, and Ron Belgau, who is in St. Louis, a professor there, on side B. God has called him to lifelong celibacy. The organization that reflects side B in this country is Accepting Evangelicals. I'll give you the website of that in a moment. Accepting Evangelicals. So the side B folk would say, same-sex attraction is not the way God intended things to be. It came as a result of sin and the fall. And somehow we need to move, help each other move from having this sense of a gay identity, seeing same-sex attraction as a temptation, and strive to live a celibate life. Wesley Hill has written a wonderful book. He's on this side B. He's written a wonderful book called Washed and Waiting. He's from the United States. He talks about his own struggle, his own attempts towards change, his own longing to be married, to be changed, but change not happening. And so how he dealt with God, his anger towards God, and how he has come to terms with this. And what they're trying to do is to try and maybe not put so much emphasis on the gay or straight, but rather we're all sexual humans becoming who God intended us to be, using our sexuality truly before him. So they like to talk not so much about post-gay, as if this is something in the past. They like to talk about post-gay, not ex-gay. In other words, it's after my seeing myself with a gay identity, now I haven't got rid of that completely. I'm not ex-gay, but it's a direction that I'm moving in. And to recognize the tendency for a wrongly centered self, where I put all my identity in my sexual orientation, and a need to be centered in identity in Christ. And maybe there is change, maybe there isn't. And this is where one needs to be open to the possibility, and perhaps working towards that, but coming to terms with the reality that it may not be so possible. So one of the people in this country, Peter Old, says this: I don't speak of myself as an ex-gay person. I prefer the term post-gay. You choose to move away from the label gay altogether, which has come to be associated with a certain lifestyle. I've clearly experienced some change in my feelings so that I am attracted to my wife. But it is definitely not a 180-degree reorientation. All of us will come to have desires and feelings which are not right until Jesus returns. So that the challenge to live with an orientation and a vulnerability that is like what Paul talks about as a thorn in the flesh. It's something that 1-3% of us did not choose. Perhaps, as I said earlier, like a vulnerability to depression. How can I be a good steward of this particular affliction that God has allowed in my life? He didn't send it, but he allowed it. C.S. Lewis has a great quote about our calling. And he says, in homosexuality, as in every other tribulation, God's works can be made manifest, i.e. that every disability conceals a vocation, if only we can find it, which will turn the necessity to glorious gain. So I think what he's saying there is that even if you find yourself with a disability, you know, if you are someone who has, as a friend of ours did, it was a gymnast, and he had an accident on a trampoline at the age of 19, was paralyzed from the waist down. How does he live with that? How does he find a vocation with that disability to help and live for others, not just for himself? And I think that's the challenge in all of this. Can people like this see this call to stewardship of their sexuality, find a calling and a vocation in singleness? Can those who are not married, who are heterosexual, or those who are married and then get divorced, or their spouse dies, how do they find a calling in their celibate singleness? That's a struggle. It's in this world, in this age where sexuality is so much pumped at us from all around to help single people remain celibate. It's regarded as the sort of really weird if you are celibate, if you think it's even possible nowadays. So that, I think, is a struggle where the church, we as a church, have to be a supportive community to provide real friendships for single people, between single and married, between single, straight, single, gay, and to enable us to live out our faithfulness to the Lord. So there is a difference between attraction and orientation and identity. And this need for a supportive community is seen, I think, in spiritual friendship, which is the group of men and women in the United States who have a website who are committed to celibacy even though they are gay. And then in this country, it's called Living Out, is the one to go to particularly. And there are a number of testimonies there from people like Sam Albury, Ed Shaw, Vaughan Roberts, who openly speak about their struggle. Sean Doherty says, "Church was a place of nurture and unconditional acceptance, but at the same time, the teaching was clear that I shouldn't act on those sexual desires. In an environment where young people were being encouraged to experiment, I was really grateful that I had been kept from acting on my feelings." And this relates back to your question about education. You know, if the church is educating young people, they will be restrained from acting on their feelings. And Sean Doherty now is married, even though he still struggles. There is still some struggle with same-sex attraction. So I would really encourage this website and the Spiritual Friendships website as well. As Wesley Hill says in Washed and Waiting, one of the most surprising discoveries I made is that the New Testament views the church rather than marriage as the primary place where love is best expressed and experienced. In heaven, Jesus said, there's not going to be marrying and giving in marriage. And in a sense, you know, as Lauren Winner says in her book on singleness and sex, singleness trumps marriage in heaven. In a sense, we'll all be the bride of Christ. We'll all be single in relation to each other, although I hope I still have a special friendship with my wife. But in a sense, we need to be a foretaste of that within the church. And I think it's a huge challenge to create that sort of environment. I'm going to go on into gay marriage and side A, is my next section here. Any comments, experiences of this? You gave one experience earlier on in your church, which was great. How do you hear this challenge? Is this something you see Christians can rise to, that we can create? Do you see it happening anywhere?
Rather than making, here's what we think about homosexuality, and by the way, here's all this other stuff.
I agree with you completely. I mean, I think we need to be talking about sex in general a whole lot more in the church. Because it's there in the Bible, there are plenty of places, and it is a wonderful and glorious thing. We don't want to be seen as killjoys, anti-sex. But you're right, we want to be able to talk about the boundaries God has given. We want to talk about what marriage is. And in a way, it is, you know, dealing with what we would see as where sex has gone wrong in a fallen world and where people have rebelled against the Creator's plans and purposes and the Maker's instructions. That comes along afterwards. But we are drawn into this debate because it's where the culture is, and they keep drawing us back to it, don't they? And that you can't, it's hard to avoid it. But to even, I mean, to talk about what we've just been talking about, that it's possible to be celibate and single, that's really bizarre and crazy for some people, for many people in the world around, many young people, because it's just coming at you. I'm going to be talking in an... Okay, let's go on then to talk about gay marriage and side A. So the gay Christian, side A, and I've given you here these two websites at the bottom of Accepting Evangelicals, which is a fairly new... This is David Gillett, who was head of Trinity College in Bristol for a while, a bishop in the Church of England, who is championing this, and people like Steve Chalk, another well-known evangelist, believe that the scriptural texts support faithful and loving same-sex relationships. And one of the things that I hear often is, how could a loving God condemn us to the loneliness of celibacy? He said, it's not good for man to be alone. Surely he wouldn't want us to be alone in this way. So Justin Lee, in his book Torn, wrestles with the scriptures and sort of reinterprets them. I now believe that homosexual behavior is appropriate within the confines of a committed, loving, monogamous, lifelong, Christ-centered relationship. So this takes us then into the revisionist view of marriage that is coming at us from the secular side as well. So Andrew Sullivan, in the New Republic, he's a very vocal spokesperson for this, the journalist in the States. He says, homosexuality at its core is about the emotional, financial, and psychological connection between two adult human beings. And what public institution is more central, more definitive of that connection than marriage? The denial of marriage to gay people is therefore not a minor issue, it is the entire issue. So we are accused, as we said earlier, of the equivalent of racism. This is a serious accusation. And they would also say that civil unions are a second best, and therefore discriminatory. You're sort of saying homosexuals are second-class citizens. They don't deserve full marriage rights, so we'll give them civil unions just to satisfy them. So that was a temporary solution, in a way. Now, we have to affirm that there are good things in a relationship of love and care between two gay people. That we can and must affirm these things. But the problem comes with a different definition of marriage. Now, sadly, many heterosexuals have come to have this view of marriage too, so that many heterosexuals now have a very low view of marriage, and they want it redefined to allow us to break it up easily and maybe even not get married at all. There's been a huge increase in children born outside of marriage in the last 30 years. So it's a sort of strange thing that while heterosexuals are saying maybe marriage is outdated, homosexuals are coming along and saying, no, we want to jump in here. We want recognition to get married too, because it's obviously an important part of society. Peter Tatchell, who was very vocal on the English scene, has had somewhat of a change of direction on this theme. And in his original view, he did not want the state regulating anything. And this was very much in line with the old Stonewall rioters in the United States at the beginning of the whole campaign for gay rights. In 1969, they said that all social institutions, including marriage, needed to be abolished. And Peter Tatchell was saying that 10 years ago, but now he campaigns hard for gay marriage. And Brendan O'Neill, back in January, I think last year, in the Telegraph newspaper in the United Kingdom, said the gay marriage campaign is about winning state recognition of gay relationships, pleading with the state to sanctify homosexual living arrangements. Where once gay activists fought to get the state out of their lives, out of their bedrooms and their bars, now they are fighting to get it back in, calling for it effectively to say, your relationships are valuable. The demand for liberation has given way to the plea for state recognition. Now, so in some propaganda from a gay organization about moving marriage forward, this was what was written. When talking about freedom to marry, share the truth, gay couples want to join marriage precisely because they respect the institution and what it means in our society. So that's the way you help it get accepted. And some are willing to take on the traditional model of marriage, and they argue that it will bring more fidelity in gay relationships, especially men, who are typically very unfaithful. The majority of married women and men, heterosexual men and women, do not engage in extramarital affairs. Approximately 90% of women are not unfaithful in their marriages, only about 10% heterosexual. And for the men, it's something like 70% are faithful within their marriages. But the number who are unfaithful in gay marriages is much higher. But they're saying, if you accept us into marriage, maybe it will restrain us and we will be more faithful. So, Marsha Gessen, who is a lesbian journalist, writes this: it's a no-brainer that homosexual activists should have the right to marry, but I also think equally that it's a no-brainer that the institution of marriage should not exist. Fighting for gay marriage generally involves lying about what we're going to do with marriage when we get there, because we lie that the institution of marriage is not going to change, and that is a lie. The institution of marriage is going to change, and it should change. And again, I don't think it should exist. And I don't like taking part in creating fictions about my life. That's sort of not what I had in mind when I came out 30 years ago. I have 3 kids who have 5 parents, more or less, and I don't see why they shouldn't have 5 parents legally. I met my new partner, and she had just had a baby, and that baby's biological father is my brother, and my daughter's biological father is a man who lives in Russia, and my adopted son also considers him father. So the 5 parents break down into 2 groups of 3, and really, I would like to live in a legal system that is capable of reflecting that reality, and I don't think that's compatible with the institution of marriage. Now, once you get into this view of marriage, of course, the question is why limit it to 2 people, or even a man and a man and a woman and a woman? Why not 3 people? Why not incest? You know, why shouldn't you marry your sister? I mean, where are the boundaries going to be in all of this? That's the big question. So we're saying that gays and lesbians have a right to live as they choose, but they cannot redefine marriage for the rest of us. Is it going to be any partnership where there is love and affection and companionship? Is that enough to make a marriage? So we're coming back to this idea of this that I quoted earlier on when I talked about the great Russian experiment with Soviet experiment with marriage, abolishing marriage. We have another gigantic social experiment, and divorce, we see now the tragedy of allowing such free divorce on families and on the children of divorce, with all the consequences that are around us. Now, so this is the first society in history to have gay marriage. And history, you know, we're just a few seconds in the span of the totality of history. So we have a breakdown of heterosexual marriage. We have gay marriage coming in. Is all this in the best interests of children, family, and society, is what we have to ask. It's interesting that the marriage rate of gays and lesbians after the new law in the Netherlands, somewhere between 12 to 20% of gay people after the law changed, 12 years ago, have got married. Although they're all clamoring for it, 12 to 20% of them, versus 86% of heterosexual couples who are living together eventually get married in the Netherlands. In California, only 20% approximately of people who were clamoring for gay marriage have actually got married. In Sweden, interestingly too, the divorce rate among gay men is said to be 50% higher than the heterosexual divorce rate. And for lesbian women, the divorce rate is hugely higher, is 170% higher. So it seems that marriage in the gay community is much more about the desires of adults, not about the care of children and the society. Now, many of them will say, you know, we have just as much right to be parents, and a number of them have adopted children. And I'm sure some gay couples are wonderful parents. They're probably a lot better parents than some heterosexual couples. But the general sort of feeling through history, and I think psychology research will eventually show this, is that children need a mother and a father, ideally. Single parents all struggle. Some of you may be single parents. It's not easy. And I think kids are made to have a mother and a father, ideally. They can exist in other arrangements, and they may come out reasonably healthy, but for the optimal health, and there are quite a lot of studies, and there are huge debates about the studies done in this area of how children come out after they're raised by gay couples. I'm not quite sure what to make of them. I hear evidence on both sides that came up recently in a California court, and the Christian guy who was bringing up the more traditional arguments for marriage and family was ridiculed in the press. Interestingly, that in the law at the moment in the UK, I understand that a homosexual couple is married. When they're married, they will not be able to divorce on grounds of adultery. Because nobody can agree what adultery is. So two guys get married and the guy goes off and has a relationship with another man, it's not defined as adultery in the way that it used to be with heterosexual marriage. This is something I learned very recently from David Robertson. So ideally, I think the Christian view and just practically, psychologically, for the health of our children and our society, the ideal direction is for two parents of different sexes. Roger Scruton, a philosopher, and Philip Blond in Marriage Equality or the Destruction of Difference say this: to pursue gay equality is noble and right, but to pursue it by undermining heterosexual institutions is deeply damaging to both hetero and homosexual persons alike. For heterosexuals need an institution that shapes them for the consequences of opposite-sex union. Without that, it is disaster and despair for children, burden and poverty for women, and dislocation and atomization of society. Now, you can always find exceptions to that, but in general, this is the direction that I think things are going. It's interesting that in the state of Utah, predominantly Mormon state, back in 1849, between 1849 and 1896, the state of Utah was not granted statehood in the United States because they allowed polygamy, because this was the Mormon belief. Well, the United States, acting predominantly from a Christian view of marriage, said, until you change this law and say marriage is between one man and one woman, for the sake of children and society, we're not going to let you in. So it took about what, 30 years for them to make that law and be accepted. So I think, as Wayne Grudem says, we can't prohibit same-sex relationships legally, but we also should not promote homosexual conduct by law, by making laws to enshrine it in law. And allowing gay marriage or promoting gay marriage is actually promoting it, I think. Now, the consequences for us are maybe really difficult. This is where we, as a minority in the culture, will experience some degree of persecution and discrimination. Some of you may have seen that. Probably in different countries it's different. The United States has a pretty large Christian representation, so that there are a lot of voices raised on that side. But in schools, in churches, in adoption and fostering agencies, especially if they are state-related, government jobs, they may lose funding, they may lose, people may lose jobs working in them if you have the view that homosexuality is not right and not to be taught. In some denominations in the United States, it's a litmus test for ordination. You can't be ordained unless you believe that that priests can be ordained or that Christians can practice homosexuality. You may be accused of hate speech, and the legal definition of hate speech is being debated, and especially in Europe here, Western Europe. In the United States, there may be a loss of accreditation and federal loans for seminaries. We have changing definitions of parenthood and gender. I understand in Sweden and Denmark, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that it's mandatory for all churches to carry out gay weddings. That's not true? In the Swedish church, the individual priest, he can have a conscientious objection and not do it. Okay. Okay. And then I read somewhere that Swedish birth certificates, they are moving to eliminate the words boy and girl on the birth certificate. So you don't actually describe the gender. So it has to be gender neutral language. Now, presumably that's not happened yet, but you can see the direction that things are going. What is your experience of this in terms of discrimination against Christians, churches, maybe jobs? Have you experienced this? Do you hear about it in your own cultures?
I'm not sure whether you cannot be ordained as a priest, but you at least have a rough time to be ordained priest if you do not accept this view of marriage,
right,
and so on. So there it's just, and that happens, that's going fast now.
Yeah.
It's just 5 years since we got the new law.
And I think we are in England running about 5 years behind you. Mm-hmm. The same thing is happening with the Anglican Church too. Mm-hmm. That the pressure will be on increasingly. It will be more difficult to get ordained if you don't accept that view. So this is in Germany. So the Association of Christian Counselors was advising their members they shouldn't work with gay people except in very prescribed way. So some felt that they had to resign from the organization and thus lost the ability to practice in general practices and things like that. Well, I think the pressure will only increase, especially I think for school teachers. I think that's going to be a vulnerable area. So what does it mean to follow Christ in this? It means accepting that In this area, we will be, I think, a persecuted minority. It's hard not to believe that that's going to happen. We have to somehow live out the gospel and point to the one who brings redemption and ultimate reconciliation. And somehow create this environment within the church that I've been talking about as a sort of alternative community that can tell another story help people to relate to that biblical story, the creation, fall, redemption, restoration model. And also, I think that another message within the church is that is working on Jesus' teaching, Paul's teaching on singleness and the high calling of singleness. Paul seems to see a high calling in marriage and in singleness in 1 Corinthians 6 and 7. And I think we need to be teaching that well too, because we tend in church to glorify marriage and to say this is the way that all Christians should go ultimately. And obviously the majority do, but single people can often feel very left out. We don't have many celebrations for single people within the context of the community of the church. So let me finish with this quote from Michael Bird, who is an Australian theologian. You probably know him. Gay marriage is here, so we need to rethink how we relate to society. Gay marriage is about a larger trend in Western society, edging towards an aggressive secularization that permits religious communities to exist, but only on the grounds of an unwritten non-interference clause. Shut up, sit down, say nothing, and please die out quietly. Fidelity in this state of exile is witnessing to a different way of being authentically human, whispering across a table that Aslan is on the move, declaring that a new thing is happening in our midst, living with different values in our single and celibate friendships, marriages, families, and churches, reflecting love in the face of prejudicial hatred, and blessing others when we are cursed, and pointing towards Jesus Christ, who brings the redemption and transformation that we and everybody in the world needs. That was a little me and Michael Bird mixed together there. But I like his emphasis there. I think it's a very real, down-to-earth way of looking at where we have come to. So, any last questions, thoughts? Yes.
I like the way you approach this whole subject. You didn't approach it in a controversial manner.
Thank you.
And to me, that seems to be something more attractive than to hold up something in the face of people, particularly in the face of people who most of them seem to be happy that they have been liberated in this way, that now they can choose, now they can make their own decision, even though, you know, Jesus may have, may look at them and have pity on them.
Yeah.
But, you know, to me it's appealing because I think that would be more attractive to these people. And I wonder how you would explain, how you would apologize for this way of being non-confrontational with such a critical subject.
Well,
this subject divides the world. I mean, it's not something for the faint-hearted.
Yeah, it divides the world. It's not for the faint-hearted. And I have been faint-hearted. I have, you know, my professional reputation. If I stick my head above the parapet, it will be shot at. And I have avoided that for a long time. I think in my older years, and I'm getting a little bolder, but I don't like conflict and confrontation at all. And David Robertson, who some of you may have heard on the internet and in the round table discussion that he did with Wayne Grudem, talks about the fact that he's very bold in speaking out about this, and he engages with all sorts of people in debate, and he's a unique character. But he gets a lot of threats, a lot of even, you know, death threats he's had because of it. But somehow, what I'm struggling to do is to find a way to engage with this topic that is not confrontational and sort of in your face, trying to emphasize the right things in it. So thank you for your encouragement in that. Yeah?
I have one question that has to do with how we respond.
It is the predicament of many parents today who whose sons and daughters come out to them, and Christian parents, and how do they respond to this? And there are some good books. There is a mother who has written an excellent book on her relationship with her son and the alienation that came between them. But her I think the main emphasis is that whatever our children do, we need to love them and respect them and treat them with dignity. And the boundaries that we set in relation, we can't make them do what we want them to do or believe what we want them to believe. So we have to show them that we love them, even though they have different views, and keep up a relationship and invite them to our home and not ban them and treat them as lepers. And, you know, and even if they have a gay friend, you might not want them to sleep together in your house necessarily, just as you might not want your daughter to sleep with your son before they're married in your house. But what they do outside of that is a whole another matter. And they might choose not to come because of that. But not to break off the relationship. And certainly, you know, I think we can affirm the good things in friendship. And we need to have a better developed view of friendship in the church, I think. And the good things that are there even in gay friendships, that are not necessarily the sexual part of it. But I would also, I think, you know, most kids know that their parents would disapprove and know what they think. It's important to clarify between you what you each are thinking, because you can often imagine the other is thinking things and being much more condemning and rejecting than they really are.
In the book called Prayer for Bobby,
Prayer for Bobby.
Yeah.
That's a book that describes a mother's struggle, a son committing suicide.
Yeah,
because he was gay. I was just looking for that other book. If I Tell You I'm Gay, Will You Still Love Me? It's Anne Mobley. It's just recently come out. But that's another reason why we have this group in First Light in St. Louis for parents, because they do struggle so much and they need other people to talk to about how they've managed. And so many parents become very legalistic and frightened and negative, and they need help, they need education, they need to know how to love their children well.
And we're in a situation now, with some of the things that are going on, we're subjecting ourselves to the tyranny of the, whatever the statistics were, 2%, 3%. In the United States, for example, we're having laws struck down that were voted on overwhelmingly by the citizens. Even Bill Clinton's defense of marriage is one that was overwhelmingly approved, and yet through a very vocal minority, all of this is being struck down. So I think we have an obligation, not only being Christians and answering to God, but also having a civic responsibility, saying for our children and our grandchildren, we have to be very active, but maybe we need to be more active.
Yeah, I think you're right in encouraging us to be active at a civic, political level where we can. And the small minority that you talk about, though, are influencing a very large group of people. So, you know, we're told in the United States that something, I don't know, like 59% of the population now are pro-gay marriage. And that's happened over the last 5 years. Very rapidly, it's come to be seen as normal. There's been a time of preparation for that. And we are seen as on the low moral ground. That's the difficulty, as homophobic bigots. And it's hard then to speak into it without just being mocked. We pray for revival, for reformation, for a new kindling of Christian morality, but we may have to go through a time when Christianity fades, as it has done in Europe. where we may be persecuted in some way. But let's not give up hope, you know. We've got to work on these things. Other comments, questions? Yes. So the question in relation to apologetic and the way we approach this, do we bring up the statistics on the greater amount of disease because of the homosexual lifestyle? And there are more sexually transmitted diseases. That people who practice anal sex are more vulnerable to sexually transmitted diseases. You're absolutely right. Of course, now with a cure for AIDS, then that alarm system has been silenced. So people say, well, it doesn't matter so much. But there are other diseases that we don't hear much about. And then the statistics on anxiety and depression and suicide and so on are quoted. There's a much higher level in the homosexual community. They come back and say, of course, well, that's because we're discriminated against. And if we weren't, then this wouldn't happen. Now, in countries where the law has changed over a period of time, I think the statistics do show there is still a higher level of depression, anxiety, and suicide in the gay community. But it's a sort of statistic that's debated from either side. How reliable is it? Where are you getting it from? What's the cause? So I have tended to avoid that tack, although it is there in the background that can be used. Yes?
A question about how we relate to this as a church, as a broad church. So thinking about side A, where you were saying that some of the even evangelical churches would come to a position where, because it's loving, that they can have marriage in a same-sex relationship. Doesn't that put aside the assumption that that marriage is God's institution and start making it man's to play with?
Well, I think they would say, I think someone like David Gillett, and I may be misquoting him, would say that, you know, God's intention is that people should not be alone, and then if they find that they are same-sex attracted, then why should they not, as long as it's consensual and loving, live in a relationship with someone of the same sex? And I think they would feel that, you know, the Bible is pointing to the highest sort of ethic in it is love between people. That they would deal with all the condemnations as being for promiscuity and unfaithfulness and idolatrous sexuality rather than sexuality in a loving, committed, honest, truthful relationship.
So it suggests that marriage has previously been defined wrongly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just repeating that for this, that it suggests that marriage has been previously defined wrongly. Yeah. I think that's true. Yeah. Yes.
There was an article in First Things this March that was called Against Heterosexuality. In which the author, his name was Hannon, he was suggesting that Christians should be champions of not using the term or sexual orientation, and he even called Michel Foucault an unexpected ally in this, showing that the term orientation was Freudian and it was an attempt to sort of replace the Christian morality with a secular morality, and then therefore you made homosexuality a disorder, a medical. And so I think his point was that we shouldn't define things this rigidly with this dichotomy between heterosexuals and homosexuals, but keep the conversation about behavior, specific acts, rather than orientation. Do you have any comment on that? And he also referenced sort of the trend within the LGBTQ etc. community that they're moving away from speaking of orientation, going towards choice and lifestyle. and he said that we shouldn't be behind on this, but should be able to follow with that conversation, mm-hmm. and we can start actually discussing behavior instead of discussing people and orientation. Mm-hmm. You know. Mm-hmm.
It's really important. I have not read that article, uh-huh. and it was one of the things on my list to read before uh-huh. I came here, and I never got to it because someone else had mentioned. So it's by Hannon, Michael Hannon, in First Things, and he's sort of following Foucault's line of not using the categories of heterosexual and homosexual because yeah. it's an artificial category when it's not actually out there in the world.
Yeah.
So let's think about this together. What is it? I mean, the Bible is talking about male and female and coming together and condemning same-sex relationship. That seems to create a category there, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Does it create a category of orientation? Because the category of orientation is almost a category of people, of an identity.
Well, an orientation is an inner experience.
Uh-huh.
Isn't it, towards, and then we put an identity. Maybe it's good to get away from the actual gay identity, gay or straight identity bit. I mean, I think there's something to be learned from this. I have yet to wrestle with the idea, have a good response to it, I'm afraid. Yeah, when with friends like this, I don't focus on the homosexual issue. The problem is often they may bring it up in terms of what you think of it. And then it's hard to get away from that, or hard to get into intelligent discussion about other things. But much better to start with the big questions of life, and if they're not Christians, with, you know, how do you know anything's true at all? So I'll leave you in peace. But thank you for your involvement and for your patient listening.
Thank you.